think there's anything wrong with a little order and predictability in your life. For instance, I might throw a tantrum if I don't get to start my day with a great cup of coffee. Luckily, I never have to worry about that because great coffee is guaranteed every day with Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf, and you can order it ground to your liking or whole bean.
I'm an excellent grinder.
But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that fresh coffee can always be a reliable part of your morning routine. And right now, Top 100 Project listeners can take 10% off their next coffee order if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, the number 100. The offer doesn't apply to gear, but it does apply to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a first-time customer to use it. The time's never been better to start making your favorite cup of coffee in your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Yeah. Yeah.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Well, hey. We welcome all you movie holics to our weekly podcast that bips and bops about classic films. Today begins Oscar month, where we will review three Best Picture winners from three consecutive 10-year spans that end in 8. Does that make sense? Well, it will as we do the month. As always, we don't mind spoiling, so we hope you won't mind either. I'm the excellent driver, Ryan Ellis, and here's my hotshot pretty boy, or I mean pretty girl, wife, Bev.
That's me.
She's Charlie Babbitt. The coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, Rain Man, come together. Wait, that's Spoon Man. Okay, anyway, of Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman, the Scientologist and the Groper, which of them has the bigger box office hit in actual money, and which has the biggest hit when adjusted for inflation?
So, I forgot to look this up. So I'm going to just take a guess. I'm going to say adjusted for inflation, Hoffman.
That's correct.
And then just biggest hit ever, Cruise.
Actually, both are Hoffman.
Really?
That surprised me, too. Meet the Fockers is the biggest hit in pure money. $279 million. And, of course, he's a supporting player, but still a movie of Hoffman's. And for Cruise, it was War of the Worlds with $234 million. Surprising that that's his biggest hit.
I'm just surprised that he doesn't have a mega hit in his list of films.
He has so many big hits, but nothing that really, truly took off. And then for adjusted money, The Graduate, which is probably what you were thinking, $764 million. And I didn't write this down, but I'm sure Tootsie was up there, too. I think he actually had two, and Tootsie probably was the second, that were way above Cruise's adjusted for inflation numbers. Cruise's biggest hit adjusted is Top Gun at 428. So 764, 428. And yet Cruise is certainly one of the biggest hit makers in the history of Hollywood, but it's more a matter of he'd make those $100 million movies in the 90s, which was excellent, but nothing really truly exploded in, of course, the modern era, or I guess a graduate level hit back in the 60s that makes trillions of dollars. Cruise's movies haven't been those types of numbers, and that was a surprise to me. That's why I asked the question. Anyway, the next 100 Project's 93rd motion picture, Rain Man, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Didn't make it, though, of course. MGM and United Artists released it in mid-December 1998. Big, big, big hit. It was the number one hit of that year. Bev explained to people what the movie's about with Lucas.
Tom Cruise is Charlie Babbitt, a fiery, ambitious car importer who's just learned that his estranged, wealthy father has died, leaving him nothing but a car, some rose bushes, and a breadcrumb trail to his secret older brother Raymond, played by Dustin Hoffman. Raymond is an institutionalized, high-functioning autistic savant with a strict routine and now his father's entire $3 million estate. Charlie is incensed by this perceived injustice and responds by taking Raymond on a road trip back to California so he can pursue custody of him and control of his fortune.
Or, in a nutshell, glib man's fancy car business fails, ironically, while he's out of town driving a fancy car. That whole thing's kind of glossed over, isn't it? That he has this big car business, he's got to deal with that, and yet he doesn't really seem to care that much when he realizes it failed.
But I thought that he had it all figured out when they won the money in the casino.
Well, that's to pay off the debts, but the cars are gone. The guy on the phone, Lenny, the cars are gone, Charlie. We gotta pay off the debts we owe. So that's what that whole thing in Vegas is all about.
But he's not ruined, and he can, like, have another shot at it.
Yes.
Although, I just have to say straight up, I don't feel sorry for a car importer that doesn't anticipate that he's going to run into problems with the EPA when he's importing fancy sports cars. Anybody with just a modicum of experience who knows what they're doing would never run into that problem.
He's the hustler, bitches about EPA regulations, so he must be a Republican.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 90% of critics like the movie, also 90% of audiences. The exact same number, 90. And in the critics section, it was 93 fresh and 7 rotten reviews. The movie was number 1 at the 1988 U.S. box office. Big, which we covered, was 4th. And Die Hard, which, yeah, we covered that way back when too, was 7th. And of course, everyone thinks of Die Hard from this year, maybe more than any other movie, including Rain Man, which was the best picture winner and the biggest hit. Rain Man was number 1 for 6 weeks in a row when it came out, even though it was thought of as a slow builder. It wasn't some giant hit right away. People got word of mouth from their friends and went to go see it. But then it got back to number 1 8 weeks later after it fell out of that spot after the Oscars. That's, of course, the re-release pattern that they will even do now, where a movie maybe isn't playing anymore, out it comes again and people go back to see it. And it's also 147th on Box Office Mojo's top 300 now. It was the top 200, but I looked just recently and now it's the top 300 because so many big hits now make it onto that 300 list. It was right behind 2001 A Space Odyssey and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. You like one of those movies for sure. I'm not sure what you think of this one yet, and I know you're not a huge fan of Guardians. But what did you think of the one we're talking about now, Rain Man?
I like Rain Man. It's an entertaining movie. The performances are as masterful as everyone says. It's unique. I think it has a really great take on mental illness. And it's responsible for a tremendous amount of understanding and empathy for autism. There's some misconceptions in there as well, but the film definitely did more good than harm. But it just doesn't draw me in. I know you really connect with it, but it just keeps me at arm's length for some reason.
It's one of those movies I liked more when I was younger. Not that I don't like it now. I like it a lot, in fact. But I loved it when I was younger, and I still like it quite a bit. I would put it in my top 5 or 10 from that year. I mean, what does that really mean anymore? And it was in my top 10 that year, but it wasn't my favorite movie. I liked Die Hard more, and Last Temptation of Christ, which we probably will cover later this year, I think is the best movie of that year. Bull really? Durham actually is my favorite movie of that year, flat out favorite. But the angle I want to take on this is something I've mentioned in other podcasts we've covered. Arcs in movies. Dustin Hoffman's terrific in this film. He won the Oscar. He was worthy of the Oscar. I don't have any problem with him winning. But Tom Cruise has the arc, and it's a great arc. Now, maybe it happens a little too fast. He goes from being a glib asshole in the beginning of the film, and then a week later, he is this loving person. And did you notice, by the way, that he barely ever swears as the movie goes on? He's this guy who says fuck quite a bit, and then towards the end, or maybe the middle of their trip, two things I noticed for sure. One, he doesn't swear much anymore, and the other thing is that whenever Raymond brings up their father, D.A.D., Charlie really softens, including the scene in the bathroom when it's, did you sing to me a lot? And he turns on the water and bangs his head, right? Because he burned the baby. And I like that touch because it's obvious that Charlie wanted to have a connection with his father despite loathing him. But he loathed him for reasons that maybe were understandable when you see that there's almost nobody at this rich, obviously influential man's funeral.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So what did Sanford Babbitt do to other people that he knew? And also, the question remains, it's said at the end of the movie by Charlie, why didn't he tell Charlie at some point, even to manipulate him if he wanted him back in his life, that he had a fucking older brother?
But we only get an impression of this man from the impression he made on his two sons. And you have one son who hates him so passionately that he didn't speak to him from the day he was like 16 years old. And then you have another son who is high maintenance, to say the least. Somebody that he, for all intents and purposes, did leave at a hospital.
Pawned him off on them.
Right. On paper, it looks like he's a terrible father to Raymond, but every time Raymond talks about him, it seems to be with this real love.
Mm-hmm.
You say the DAD, I'm an excellent driver because his dad used to let him drive around.
Slow in the driveway.
He loved his father, and his father loved him. You see that reflected in, what's the guy's name, the guy who cares about Raymond?
Dr. Bruner.
Dr. Bruner loves Raymond in a way because of this obligation he feels towards Raymond's father.
Yeah, he even says it's loyalty towards your father, Charlie.
Yeah, so we know there was a good man in there. He was a complicated person. You talk about Cruise's arc. It doesn't feel fast that he turns around and loves Raymond at the end of the film. I feel like it comes through in his performance. Nothing he does is actually motivated by greed. He wants the money, of course. But he wants the money, I think, more out of spite. Mm-hmm. And this anger he has towards his father, this resentment that his father did have a son that he seemed to love and look after, but also that he kept secret from him. And that anger comes from loneliness. Like, I think that Levinson and the actors never forget that that's what's driving Charlie. It's not that desperation for money. I mean, when he loses that deal, he's a hustler. He's going to make another deal. He's going to get rich. It's going to happen. He knows that he can make his own fortune. He doesn't actually need his father's money. But under the surface, he's playing a man who wants family more than he wants $1.5 million, half of his inheritance. And that's why it feels genuine when he connects with Raymond so completely in the third act of the film.
I also forgive it because it's a movie, and movies have to make these things happen in about 2 hours.
But I just forgive it because I think it works.
Oh, I do too. I'm not trying to be too critical of it. I asked the question because I always thought of this as one of the great arcs in movies that isn't acknowledged as one. Cruise takes so much shit from movie critics. A lot of them have said he's not a very good actor. I think this and Born on the 4th of July the next year, Jerry Maguire, Magnolia, and many others prove the guy's a terrific actor. Yes, he's a movie star first, but he can be a character actor like in this movie. Apparently, Cruise and Hoffman in rehearsals would exchange roles, just like William Hurt and Raul Julia did on Kiss of the Spider-Woman. And that's how they would get to know each other's role even better. Now, can you imagine the fun it would be to watch Cruise playing, yeah, I'm an excellent driver, and then Hoffman be the, Ray, Ray! Would be fun to see how they each played it.
Hoffman was originally cast as Charlie.
He was supposed to be the lead, and then he didn't want to play Charlie. But then when he got the role of Raymond, because he latched on this autistic name Kim Peek, and that's who Barry Morrow, one of the writers, gave the Oscar to after the movie was over with, well, after he won the Oscar, which was a nice touch. But Hoffman latched on to this guy and other autistic people, and he wanted to play the role. But then during filming, he thought he was doing such a bad job, he wanted to quit. Obviously stuck with it, won the Oscar, all the raves, the movie was a huge hit. But then ironically, he kept on working with Levinson. So I'm not saying there was bad blood when it was the whole, I gotta quit, Barry, I'm out of this movie. But they worked again many times. He never worked with Mike Nichols again, despite the fact he revered him from The Graduate and talked so well about him after all these years. But he worked with Levinson, I think, 3 or 4 more times.
And what makes his performance transcend is that, while he doesn't have nearly the arc that Charlie has, he's doing so much more than an impersonation of an autistic person. There's just so much humanity in his performance. It feels so believable. And he partially based his performance off, as you said, Kim Peek. They call him a mega savant. Now, he was diagnosed with autism, but then later on, it was considered a misdiagnosis. He was never actually autistic. He had FG syndrome, which basically means the hemispheres in his brain, they were separate. There was no connecting tissue between them. Mm. And then the connecting tissue developed its own, this improvised system connected to the two hemispheres of his brain as he was growing up. But then it just created this like very strange system. He just has a really strange brain, and he couldn't like button up his shirt. He had an IQ of 87, which is well below average, but he could read a book in 1 hour and memorize the entire thing.
Much like Raymond with the baseball cards.
Yes. He did this thing, I guess because he has separate hemispheres, where he could be reading a book and his left eye was reading the left page and the right eye was reading the right page simultaneously. So he was famous for this. I think he was on TV here and there. Like, he had a bit of a reputation. Not that he was a circus freak or anything, but his father would show him around to people and he was of great interest. Incredibly rare, though, for anybody to be that low-functioning and brilliant at the same time. Savants are actually incredibly rare, but a lot of people mistake autistic people for savants because one of the things with autism is that they get really hyper-focused when they're interested in something, and so they tend to learn every single little thing about it. A good example of that, again, is the baseball cards. Autistic person is interested in baseball, they might memorize every single stat, and they'd be able to recite that to anybody. It makes them seem like they're very smart, but it's actually just that they devote all of their energy to the one topic they're interested in, and they're very good at focusing that energy into study or practice.
And Raymond in Rain Man is addicted to game shows and TV in general. 5 minutes to Wapner. Loves Jeopardy, just like we love Jeopardy. Writes down all the results and that kind of thing. But you're right. I can relate to some of those things, too, because I've written down stats and I've memorized stats in the past. I can't rattle them off like this guy can, but I can relate to that to an extent.
Okay, you may not be able to rattle off those specific things, but give me the Oscars for 1965.
Sound of Music, Best Picture and Director. Actress was Julie Christie for Darling. Actor, Lee Marvin and Cat Ballou, supporting actor. I don't recall off the top of my head here, and supporting actress, I forget. That's a little far back. I'm not as good with those.
Oh, wow, guys. That is one of the few times I've ever seen him falter.
I might remember that ones as we go along.
You may not be a card counter, but
I got 4 of the 6. And Charlie got the rose bushes. He definitely got the rose bushes. Did you notice that touch that he says, not having met Raymond yet, what becomes a Raymond staple? Definitely, definitely. Since I've definitely got the rose bushes. Definitely.
Ah.
There's a lot of nice touches actually in the film that I've never really heard anybody else bring up before. That's been brought up by other people. But the very first shot of the film during the Aiko Aiko sequence, I love that song. I don't know if it was original to this movie or if it was something from before.
Oh, it can't be, right? I mean, I feel like I used to sing that song on camp.
Oh, maybe. Okay, fine. But the very first shot is a flying car, effectively. I mean, it's on cables, but it looks like a flying car. And I, and you too, just recently saw La Dolce Vita, which has the flying cross. I wonder if that's supposed to be an homage to that classic film. Another nice touch is that when Susanna, and that's Valeria Galino, is bothering Charlie, the audio tunes her out. And that's where he says, "When I was a kid, the Rain Man would come and sing to me." The audio tuning her out makes me think, is there a very small touch of autism in Charlie himself? But it's also a matter of him not really respecting her at that point in the movie and tuning her out, arguing with her constantly. She interrupts him. Do you notice how often she interrupts him, which you don't see in movies very often? Barry Levinson did that deliberately when he played the scene at the end as the adjudicator, I guess you'd call it, between Dr. Bruner and Charlie about custody of Raymond. Levinson did it to irritate Cruz. That was the point. He was improvising, interrupting him. Can I speak? I'd like to speak. Can I talk? But I noticed it in this screening especially that Galino does it a ton early on in the film. And he has to explain to her. Now, she is maybe supposed to be the audience, so it could be Charlie the explainer about things like autism. Well, he doesn't really know what that is either, but he has to explain all kinds of things, including his history with his father. Why would he tell anybody about it except she wants to know? And he obviously never said anything before. But I do like the touch that seems to be that the actress is almost irritating the actor. I'm not saying that Cruz had a problem with her, but she was probably directed to interrupt him.
That is how people talk.
Yeah.
People, movies like natural conversations.
Like right now.
Interrupt each other. Yeah, they talk over each other. It's like a Robert Altman thing, right? But that is how people naturally speak.
Mm. And then, of course, he decides to kidnap his brother. Well, kidnap's a strong word. And then it's time for a road trip, because this is, of course, a road trip movie. And it was mostly shot sequentially, and obviously a ton of it was out on the Midwest roads between Ohio and then California. I don't think the movie had that big a budget, considering. But then it is mostly just two actors in the whole film. You got Galino for a decent chunk of it, and Jerry Mullen playing Dr. Bruner, and then Levinson's got the role, and the woman who plays Iris, Lenny. But there's not many other actors in the whole film, apart from little bit parts. Bonnie Hunt, of course, is the waitress with the toothpicks, and she'd go on to steal Jerry Maguire from him and everybody else in that film. She's great as the sister in Jerry Maguire. But they worked together briefly in this film first. One of the more famous things in the whole film, besides Excellent Driver and the Wapner stuff, is the Who's On First routine. I'd never seen or heard of that until I saw this movie. And I like how in that routine, Costello gets agitated just like Cruz does. Abbott is the one in that old routine. And by the way, I saw that movie, The Naughty 90s, just a week or so before we actually watched Rain Man. Just coincidentally, I rented it. I'd never seen it before. And that sequence is pretty funny, and it's so well played by those guys. They'd done it before, though, and they made it work for that movie. It didn't really belong in that film. There's an old routine of theirs. But when Raymond does it, it's his nervous twitch, of course. And Cruz gets so pissed off at him early on for doing it. It's funny. Why don't you read it as funny? But, of course, that's just what he does. That is the crutch for Raymond to get through life, basically. And I like the touch, too, when he goes to Charlie's apartment at the end. It's not just another place, Ray. It's my place. And in the background, in a light audio, you can barely hear it, he's doing the Who's On First routine, implying Raymond's never going to be comfortable anywhere other than Walbrook.
I guess he could eventually get comfortable there and consider it his home if they decided to go that way. But the notion that he could trust that just because Charlie says so is what's impossible. There's so many things that are so impossible for Raymond, and this is actually one of the things that I really like about the movie. It's quite dedicated to kind of the notion of accepting things as they are. The magic of it is that it's not about Raymond getting better. He doesn't have a breakthrough. He doesn't come a step closer to joining the world. The movie is clear that Raymond can't and won't change. He is better off remaining institutionalized. That doesn't mean his life can't be improved by a relationship with a brother who cares about him, who will, in a way, replace his father who cared about him. It just means that the world has to meet him on his terms. And Charlie is the one that has to undergo the arc. He has to meet Raymond where he is and reap the benefits of a relationship with an older brother that way. At one point, Charlie, frustrated with him, I think he's like tapping him on the side of his head. He's like, I know there's a person inside there, Raymond. He's in there somewhere. And he is, but in the end, it's Charlie that just simply has to trust that's what's true, and that that person is in there. That's a pretty responsible way, I think, to approach this type of illness, because people who are autistic, they can get better at coping, but they are never going to be like the rest of us.
You can make connections, but you can't fix everything. And maybe the small connections are enough, like at the end where it's Main Man, Charlie, and Raymond lays his head against Charlie, and that was a Hoffman improv to do that. He wasn't supposed to touch him. But I'd like the touch, too, right towards the end, the last scene, when they go to the train station. Charlie has started to smell the roses when Raymond says, it's very shiny, the train. Yeah, it is. It's not like he just blows that off or ignores it or doesn't care. He actually looks and says, wow, that is a shiny train.
Because at the end of the film, Charlie's not lonely anymore. All the arguments he has with his girlfriend in the beginning of the film, all of that is just this outpouring of anger and resentment over a father that didn't love him well enough and didn't love him properly, wasn't a good father and didn't give him that base. And so he's heartbroken about that. That wound is freshly opened by his father dying. And he's taking it out on her. But that's just an expression of his hurt. Not that he's a bad person. He might also be a bit of a jerk, but yeah.
He must be a great lay for Susanna to come back in Vegas. I don't know how she finds them in Vegas, but he must have been great in bed, because when she left, she had had it with him. She was pissed. That was the end of it. And he was a dick.
Yeah,
and
rightfully
was,
so. Like,
and what he was doing was wrong,
away.
Too. What he was doing, she knew. She was accusing him of being very wrong. So why she went back, I don't really know, but it's one of those things. The movie had to make it happen, so it happened.
And she's a great bit of heart. Of course, she's like far too patient with him, but she's a great touch in the film, and she has so much... She's a vivacious personality. She's like really just a lovely screen presence. I'm surprised she didn't remain a bigger star.
She was in Immortal Beloved, which I like a lot. One of the love interests for Beethoven, but not a lot of other big movies. That's not really a big movie either.
Did she have much of a career back in Italy, where she's from?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think she's mostly been a Hollywood actress, and she's been in some good movies, but you'd think she'd get something big out of this because it was such a monster hit and everyone saw it, and it won all the awards, but no, she didn't really have the kind of career that she might have had. I just said that Hoffman improvised the laying the head on his brother scene, which is maybe a little bit spurious. He does let Charlie touch him when they dance, but then when Charlie goes to hug him, ah! So even that's toward the end of the journey, he still doesn't like to be touched. So then a few questions. Would he let Susanna kiss him? Maybe that's one thing, but a bigger question is, would he let the stylist and the tailor touch him to style his hair and to put him in that suit?
That's a good question. We have an autistic person in our family, so I've read some books about it and what have you. That whole notion that they hate certain sensations and certain things are overwhelming is absolutely true. It's surprising, actually, more that he could spend hours in a casino and concentrate. Maybe concentrating on the cards is what gave him the ability to ignore all the lights and sounds and sensations and people crowding him and all the things that should be driving him crazy. I've read it described, the notion of how overwhelming those sensations can be and just how unpleasant it is.
Well, Vegas, the Babbitts are good at blackjack, so get out! Vegas is so fucking corrupt, and I think that's probably based on reality. If you start winning, they make you leave, which is such bullshit. The whole thing about, we're counting cards, you better leave here, son, those are the best odds you're gonna get. You're beating the game, what the fuck is that about? That's one thing about Vegas I do not like. If you're good enough to win, anyway, next people probably agree with me. But one nice touch in the film, by the way, in 1988, Cruise also did Cocktail, which my sister and I loved as kids. I haven't seen it as an adult. I might mock it a lot now, although a great soundtrack. But in both movies, Cocktail and Rain Man, the Cruise character passes up just walk away payoffs with Raymond in this film and with the girlfriend, Elizabeth Shue, the eventual wife in that film, her father, and Dr. Brunner. Here's money, just walk away and leave it alone. But he refuses, and that, of course, is the character thing that this guy has. I can't do it. Money's not the issue for me anymore.
Money was never the issue for him. I'll stand by that.
What did you think of the ending, where Raymond does go back to Walbrook? Hoffman insisted that Raymond go back. I don't know if he said, I'll quit, or we can't make the movie or something, if they didn't do that, like Pitt did about Seven, if they changed the ending of that film. But he thought that was the way it had to end, and I think he's right. I also think that Charlie made the decision the morning of the hearing, when everything seems normal, but Raymond starts the microwave oven, and then forgets about it, and starts a fire, and he's banging his head against the glass. Charlie makes it stop. Raymond stops banging his head, and he goes back to normal. Charlie sits down, and the look on his face says, this is a normal nothing day, and this happened. So during the custody hearing, or the preliminary hearing, whatever the hell you even call it, he is arguing for Raymond. So you could say, well, no, he still wanted him. And then, of course, when Raymond can't determine between being with Charlie or going back to Walbrook, then Charlie realizes, okay, enough, stop humiliating him. But I think that in the morning he's made that decision, and he doesn't want to admit it to himself.
I agree with you, and when he makes that decision, yeah, it's probably something like that, just the realization. But it's a realization, I think, he knows that Raymond doesn't belong with him. He can't be his caretaker. He needs something that he can't give him. If the movie ended with Raymond getting somewhat better, and Charlie actually taking him into his home and then becoming a family and living together, I don't know if I would like it as much. I think one of the things I like about this movie is that it has this pragmatic ending, and that pragmatic ending can be a happy ending. I think it's like a Hollywood thing, this notion that institutionalization is always this death sentence. It's just like you're sending someone off to hell. I don't believe it always has to be that way, and I think that there's lots of stories where institutionalizing somebody in the right facility for the right reasons can save their family and save the patient as well. Like, some people just need things that a normal home absolutely cannot give them. And Raymond, for all of his problems, seems to actually be a happy person, living a happy life.
At Walbrook, yeah. If you want to consider this movie a love story of sorts, most of the best movie love stories have ended with the characters not together.
But aren't they together?
No.
No, no, they're going to be apart, but he has a brother now. They're going to visit, they're going to spend time
with I'll see you in a couple weeks, yeah. Mm. But they're not together. He didn't win the way that a lot of people in movies would expect him to. Apparently some of the comment cards during screenings of this film said things like, or one did anyway, I wish the little guy would snap out of it.
Oh my God.
The little guy, I like that too. That Hoffman is short, but Cruise is also pretty short.
Yeah, they're kind of the same height. It's not that much of a stretch to believe that they're brothers, actually.
So Hoffman, we've covered him so many times in the podcast, but not in a long time, because he was in The Graduate, Midnight Cowboy, All the President's Men, and Tootsie on the Top 100 list. We covered those so long ago. He was going to play Charlie, and then Raymond may have been any number of people, but these names were bandied about. Jack Nicholson, Robert De Niro, and either of the Quaids, Randy or Dennis.
I also saw Bill Murray in the mix.
Charlie, I think, right?
No, I saw it as Raymond.
Okay.
That would have been a huge casting mistake. I love Bill Murray, but good God.
They got the casting right in this film. Hoffman worked in an institution when he was a young man. He talked about that on the AFI's first show, the 1998 Top 100 show, when he talked about Cuckoo's Nest. So he'd seen a lot of stuff like this. He had stuff to draw on, and maybe that's why he thought he wasn't getting it, because he saw how authentic they were, and he didn't think he was authentic. But one thing Levinson told him to do, and this is some brilliant direction by the guy who won the Best Director Oscar, when you don't know what to say or don't know where to go, or if you do forget a line, don't say anything, or say, yeah, or repeat yourself, or even repeat the other person's line, because that's what Raymond would do.
Mm-hmm.
Great direction.
And a great, really great performance. He earned the Oscar. I know it's like a joke that whenever you're playing somebody with a mental illness or developmental disability of some kind, that's your ticket to winning the Oscar.
This solidified that theory from the Tropic Thunder thing with Robert Downey Jr., definitely.
But it is so much more than an impersonation. He really sells that character and that his tantrums aren't just a performance. His tantrums come from this place of great discomfort.
They feel authentic. He's one of the most authentic actors of all time. But as he tarnishes legacy, we're probably going to have to talk about this a lot in our podcast long term, because God knows who else is going to be brought out as some kind of groper, assaulter, or even a raper. And he's on that list, but is not as bad as Weinstein or Spacey. Still pretty bad.
What Weinstein, who we'll be talking about next week.
Mm-hmm. As a producer, yeah. Though, at least, not as an actor.
I find it deeply disappointing. His behavior is not illegal. It's not assault. It's certainly far from the worst that we've seen, but I've been saying this over and over again. When someone behaves the way he behaved, or the way, say, Aziz Ansari behaved, or Al Franken, it's not assault, but it is indicative of a very dismissive and somewhat contemptuous attitude towards women. And as a woman, it makes it really hard for me to like these people ever again.
It shouldn't be just because you're a woman. That's pretty bad from anyone.
No, it's true. Everybody should be disgusted by that kind of behavior and those kinds of attitudes. I think I likened it to when you discover that somebody uses the N-word in private. We should all stop liking Paula Deen, no matter how charming we may have found that, like, ever cared about Paula Deen, just as, like, the first example that came to my head.
Well, we found out about Hoffman doing this stuff, I think, a few months ago, right? We've seen the movie since that happened, so when you're watching it, does it affect your thoughts on it?
I wish it didn't, but it does with everything I've seen since The Great Reckoning that we're going through right now. And every time we've seen something, and we recently watched Trumbo, and Louis C.K. is in it, and I'll be damned if I could forget that I was watching Louis C.K.
Despite the fact that it's a fantastic performance and a supporting role. Absolutely.
Well, I think I said to you, I was like, what a crime to us that we've been robbed of this actor, but he's the one that robbed us of this actor. The reason we don't get to enjoy his work anymore, when he committed those acts against those women, we can be mad, but we have to be mad at him. He's the reason that we can't enjoy it. Dustin Hoffman is the reason that I'm always going to enjoy every Dustin Hoffman movie just a little bit less, because now I know he's a creep who looks down on women and thinks that he's entitled to behave the way he did.
Especially through an assistant.
And she was 17 as well.
Oh, right. Well, Tom Cruise has been accused of nothing so far.
You say that. Tom Cruise may not be part of The Great Reckoning, but his relationship with Scientology also spoils this movie for me. Yeah. I have reached the point, because we've been watching Leah Remini's show, and because we watched Going Clear and everything I've learned about Scientology, it is also getting very hard for me to enjoy Tom Cruise movies.
And this is the first one we've ever covered for the podcast, I think.
Yeah, that's right. I can't get it out of my head when I watch him.
Well, in this movie, he's got the Barry Levinson rings. If you ever seen Barry Levinson do an interview, he's got two rings on, I think, his right hand, the pinky and the ring finger, and so does Cruise. I'm sure that was kind of like the Kubrick thing with Peter Sellers taking his glove for Dr. Strangelove. That was something that Kubrick wore on the movie set when he would work with lights and stuff, and Sellers said, I gotta have that for my performance. Well, Cruise with the rings, I'm sure, is the same kind of deal. It seems like it to me, anyway. He made those Ray-Ban shades famous, which is not surprising for Cruise. He's made other things famous by wearing them or using them or saying them. I think he's an underrated talent, despite some of the things we just talked about with his personal life and his married life.
I don't dispute his talent.
But he's mostly made action flicks the last few years. And it's unfortunate because this guy can be a very good actor, but he's doing the Jack Reacher movies and he's doing the Mission Impossible movies, which I've liked. I think he's great in those films, but I don't think he's really stretching himself at all anymore. Maybe he just wants to have hit after hit, but those movies aren't really even that big a hit. He really should be trying to stretch himself with a Magnolia or a Born on the 4th of July or a Rain Man.
Yeah, I wonder why he's just sticking to the action films. Although he has made one of my favorite action films of this decade, which is Edge of Tomorrow, Live, Die, Repeat. What title have they gone with?
That's right. That wasn't that long ago. That was a good film, for sure.
A great film, and he's wonderful in it. He's a great leading man. Mm.
Jerry Mullen, plays the trike doctor in Jurassic Park, and he was a producer on Schindler's List, and he is Dr. Bruner in this movie. When you see him acting like he has that brief role in Jurassic Park, and of course this movie, he's pretty good. He should have acted more often, or maybe still could. I don't know if he's dead or not. I didn't look it up. But anyway, Ralph Seymour is Lenny, the guy who works with the cars back home. He was in Fletch and Empire of the Sun and has made nothing since 2002. Lucinda Jenny is Iris, the hooker in Vegas, who obviously is not going to come back for that date. Got to go on the date with Iris. And that's also the name of the prostitute Jodie Foster plays in Taxi Driver, Iris. And we mentioned Bonnie Hunt, but also Beth Grant, the Sparkle Motion mother from Donnie Darko, is the farmhouse mother of all those kids when she lets them in to watch Wapner. He's going to have a conniption or throw a fit on your porch if you don't let us in right now. Nice cut in there. And the kids, for some reason, are sitting there watching. Just go and play. It's a nice day. Why are you inside anyway?
I just don't believe for one second that anybody would take that argument and be like, oh, by all means, bully your way into my house with your weirdo brother.
The director, Barry Levinson, had worked on Diner, The Natural, and Good Morning Vietnam before this. This just made it that much bigger, his career at that point. Although he's one of those guys who's made nothing, kind of like Rob Reiner, for a long time. Wag the Dog in 97 with Dustin Hoffman. One of his better performances, by the way, Dustin Hoffman. But since then, I don't know if he's made anything all that good, and certainly not very many things. And yet you look at that roster, whether you like those movies or not, Diner, Natural, Good Morning Vietnam, this, Wag the Dog, and then kind of petered out.
I agree, except for The Natural, which is a movie I hate.
A lot of people do. A lot of people love it. Steven Spielberg was supposed to do this movie at one point. He was doing a lot of prep work, and he later gave his notes to Levinson, but he dropped out to do Last Crusade for Lucas. Martin Brest and Sidney Pollack were also thought of for the movie. It's one of those things, and sometimes the Best Director Oscar ends up going to a guy who was the fifth or sixth or tenth choice, and this is one of those examples. The two writers were Barry Morrow and Ronald Bass. Their resume really just says Rain Man and nothing else anyone really cares about. Bass worked on Stepmom, but that's about it. Morrow's his mediocrity, but Morrow did give his Oscar to Kim Peek, and that's very nice. The producer was Mark Johnson, but Mullen was a co-producer. And John Peters and Peter Guber were executive producers. They wanted to produce Batman the very next year. John Peters is the guy who was Streisand's hairdresser. And Peter Guber ran something with Peter Bart. They had a TV show on AMC at one point that I started watching. I remember they used to promote Breaking Bad during their show in the commercial breaks, and I sloughed it off and never watched it for years.
I finally got you to watch it.
Okay, yeah. The movie is 185:1. We watched a very spotty DVD, which looks at its worst in that opening scene when the car is going through the air and the Ico Ico song is playing. The cameraman, John Seo, who worked on Mad Max Fury Road not that long ago, and he won an Oscar for The English Patient. The editor, Stu Linder, won an Oscar for Grand Prix in the 60s and has usually edited Levinson's films. What do you think of the cutting?
Can't say anything bad about it. It was perfect. The pacing is great. Good ups and downs. I think they did a great job.
And Linder was nominated for the editing but did not win. The composer, Hans Zimmer, we've talked about him a lot in recent years because we covered Thelma Louise and The Lion King. He's certainly known for the Nolan movies. Blah, blah. But this score is very sparse. It was nominated for the Oscar, but there's not that much of it.
It reminded me a little, actually, of Thelma and Louise, another road movie. I felt that there were similarities. The movie's likened to that.
Zimmer has built up quite a resume. He may go down as one of the great composers. I don't know if he's quite at that level.
He's not already.
The Williams, the Goldsmiths, and the Steiners of the world. But yeah, he's one of the great modern composers. The influence. This movie put a face on something that people didn't understand, which was autism, of course. People didn't even know what it was in a lot of cases. So there is a lot of explaining going on, like taking Raymond to a small-town doctor who knows a little bit about it. It established Cruise as a serious actor after The Color of Money started that process. And one thing I've mentioned many times, probably in this podcast, or certainly to people I know, that, again, Kreese does not get enough credit for, is he works with so many big-name directors, probably more than most actors of any type, whether it be a character actor or a star. Spielberg, Scorsese, Coppola, I'm drawing a blank on all their names, but a lot of big-name people he's worked with, PTA, of course, Brian De Palma, and on it goes. But he also works with big-name actors, not afraid to work with a Hoffman or a Newman before him, or Robert Duvall a couple years after this. And that's pretty cool that he is a big-name star, and he's had power in his movies since the mid-80s, and a lot of times he's in the editing room despite just being a producer on these movies, or not even being a producer on these films. But that's pretty cool for a guy that people have said a lot of things about, but he works with big names and isn't apparently afraid of being upstaged or outshined by a big-name director or a co-star.
He's one of the few big male movie stars of his generation that's never directed a film.
And character-wise, even story-wise, this is kind of Jerry Maguire with autism. There's even a childlike Ray in both movies. An actual child and a childlike version.
And he's trying to, like, hustle his way into making his own company.
The asshole who becomes a softie and learns some shit. And two of his best performances ever are in Rain Man and in Jerry Maguire.
Well, I wonder if Cameron Crowe cast him because he knew he was capable of making that turnaround from being someone so unlikable and kind of bad to somebody that you 100% root for.
The awards and list section. The movie won 4 Oscars, Best Picture, Best Director for Levinson, Hoffman as Best Actor, and the screenplay by Morrow and Bass. It was nominated for the editing, the cinematography, the music, and the sets. And it was at these Academy Awards, 1989, so the 88 movies, where they started saying, and the Oscar goes to, you mentioned we saw Trumbo, and during that they show Kirk Douglas presenting an Oscar in the 60s and saying, no, the 50s, and saying, and the Oscar goes to, and I said to you right then, that's not authentic. No way. It was long before they started doing that. I really do wish they'd just say the winner is. It's this whole thing, oh my God, I'll feel bad if they don't call me a winner, if I'm a loser. You're not a loser. You're at the Oscars in a fucking nominated performance. It's good enough, isn't it?
I love how much passion you have for this.
That's one of those dumb things about the Oscars. The Oscar goes to you. Well, they do it with the Golden Globes, too. Probably the other award shows. I don't really watch them, but I bet it's the same. Rain Man was 63rd in the Top 100 Cheers, so most inspirational. It's a Wonderful Life was number one, and it was nominated for the Top 100 Quotes with, I'm an excellent driver. What are your last thoughts?
Well, I don't love it, but I like it a lot. I would say that if it's been a while since you've seen it and you're wondering if it's worth revisiting, it definitely stands up. It's aged really well. Great performances by some actors perhaps we don't like as much as we used to. But I can't dispute the film's popularity with both critics and audiences. It's a good one.
It's got a good sense of humor, too. And that's not surprising because Levinson did write and direct Diner. And Good Morning Vietnam he directed as well. Wag the Dog. The guy is a comedy director who does drama, not a dramatic director who can do comedy. Okay, Rain Man's done. When we speak to you again in a week, we'll cover the one that took home the big prize 10 years after a Rain Man. The surprise champion of 1998, and we just watched it about 45 minutes ago, Shakespeare in Love. A lot of people out there are probably booing, which is not fair. Anyway, we'll talk about that plenty next week. The coming attractions trivia for Shakespeare in Love. Which member of the SIL cast has appeared in the most Best Picture winners, sticking with the Oscar theme? Who's been in the most winners of the big prize?
All right, so for the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about Shakespeare in Love. And if you crave more Ryan and Bev between now and then, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, check out our entire roster. We've covered well over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and/or 2007 list of the best American films ever made. Every episode is available for free, but if you'd like to thank us, you can do that with a rating and a review. That means a lot to us. It helps
5 stars.
Whatever.
5 stars. You're an excellent reviewer.
I'm a very good podcast. I'm an excellent podcaster. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT, all one word, TOP100PROJECT, not case sensitive.
Kmart sucks.
And cut.
What difference does it make where you buy underwear? Underwear is underwear, whether you buy it at Kmart or wherever!